for me, time is the resource for that ministry in daily life, as well as the conflict for that ministry. Time is that scarce, non-renewable commodity. And we have the press of activities, listening to the life of the magic strings and how all of the disparate activities of a family that large get done is a microcosm, I think, of what happens for all of us. How do we decide which of many activities to do that? So time becomes, in a sense, the enemy when it becomes so scarce. It seduces us into somehow betraying those we love. It seems so often the choices we make in time are not for those whom we say we love and care about. And it also seems to undermine, at times, the values that we know sustain us as we make those compromises and adjustments for time. Well, I've talked enough. I have two teenagers, so I am used to being interrupted. I don't expect to finish sentences, so I hope you'll stop me. And what I'd like to do is take some time right now to find out if we can't work together on this issue of time. What I'd like you to do is talk to me about when you feel harried, not enough time. And I also like you to talk to me about when there is lots of time, when you feel relaxed, life is just a pleasant stream rolling along, and you feel as though there's plenty of time, or that time itself is suspended. Just describe for me, and there's no order and there's no right answer, let's just list a bunch of those experiences, those situations on both sides of the fence here. When do you feel harried? When you don't have enough time? When do you feel relaxed?
I feel harried when I try to take on too many projects, and I feel relaxed just about only when I go on vacation.
Okay.
Totally relaxed, don't worry. No phones.
Okay. No phones here. And on vacation.
Meals on the left with teens.
Meals with teens. Time to be harried. Okay. When else? Come on. I'm assuming that these are experiences that we all have. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be in this room with me. You'd be next door talking about loneliness.
Timelines when they're either self-imposed or imposed on you.
Okay. Imposed timelines.
Expectations to perform.
Ah. Expectations.
High standards.
Okay. Form. High standards make you hairy?
Yeah.
Okay. So far, this isn't a very relaxed group. Anytime?
That's probably why we're here.
Yes, please.
Well, I would like something on both sides. When there are meetings and companies coming and there are fancy meals to prepare,
uh-huh.
And on the other hand,
social
when I'm alone, when Leo's on a trip,
uh-huh.
And my schedule is
programmed.
Well, there's no rigid schedule.
Okay, no rigid schedule. Good. Okay.
And lots of time when I'm doing something other than what I'm doing in the hairy side, be it fishing or reading for pleasure or listening for pleasure or whatever.
Good.
We're going to fishing now.
Yeah, let's go fishing. Pleasure, by its nature, seems to be relaxing. That's really an interesting insight. I hadn't thought of the connection before, but that, yeah. Please.
Inheritance and traveling by flight.
Okay.
In India, traveling.
Traveling by plane or in India, traveling.
No straight line. I heard that earlier.
Other experiences.
Lots of time when I finally get so harried that I'm just so sick of all of it and I shove it all aside.
Shove it all aside.
Lots of time.
Okay. Any other time? Yeah.
Certain people with whom I can be fairly relaxed, but not too many. So usually I'm involved a lot of groups and things. So I guess that one for each side would be big groups of people.
Uh-huh.
Most people in general. Sometimes family can drive me nuts too.
Okay.
Just a couple people that I've really learned to relax with.
Okay. There are certain people who seem to help us be relaxed. I have that same experience. We have Sunday morning breakfast with another couple, and both of us live insane lives. But somehow that Sunday morning seems to be a relaxing time. Any other experiences? I think I got more room I can write. Yes, please.
Well, Harry would be just when a person is tired physically.
Ah, physical fatigue. Okay.
On the other side, sleep.
Sleep. An exquisite pleasure called sleep. Yes?
Church.
Church.
During sermons is when I feel so relaxed. They are. On a Sunday morning, it's a very relaxing time to
yep.
sit back, just listen.
Yep. It is true. It is trained. We've all been trained to do that. I don't know.
It becomes such a peaceful time.
Yeah. Either that or boring. I don't know which, but... I'm a member of University Lutheran Chapel in Berkeley, and I get off on these stories, and I might as well just do it. And I agreed to help National Lutheran Campus Ministry with their endowment campaign, and so I got to attend the National Lutheran Campus Ministry Conference. And I was asked to speak, and I did, and my pastor, Gus Schultz, is involved in the sanctuary movement. He was the next speaker. He got up, he said, I really appreciated the chance to hear one of my parishioners speak. He said, though, I should have sat up front and fallen asleep instead of sitting in the back and paying attention. So I get so relaxed that I sleep. One time, one of my secretaries happened to also be a member of the parish, and she and the other person sitting next to her would have a pool to see how long it would take for me to fall asleep. Okay. Other pieces of this puzzle. Yes?
Listening to music is relaxing. And also working with animals. Those that do that. That's pets.
Why is working with pets?
I don't know. I grew up on a farm, so there's something about animals that really relax me. I don't know.
Okay.
Just make everything else seem kind of silly.
Physical exertion is relaxing, too.
Good.
Gardening and mowing the lawn, riding a bike, or walking or swimming.
Being out of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow just getting away from the city becomes, I feel much more relaxed.
I often talk with folks about time management in a business or a organizational sense. And so I've done this often. I mean, you're not the first group that I've done this with. I've probably done this 100 times. And I am always amazed at how similar the lists begin to be. Instead of Leo being gone, however, usually almost every time when the boss is gone or when I'm on vacation or when there aren't any phones. Or there's some sort of pleasurable activity. I often work with secretaries and administrative assistants of nonprofit organizations because they're the people that do all the work anyway, and one of my goals is to help them to be more effective and also to experience less stress. And this is always interesting. What is it about these two lists? I mean, in one sense, it's really confusing to me, and it's still confusing. Time is the same. There's 24 hours every day. And Leo said it's exactly 22 minutes. Now, he may be off a minute or so, but in general, time is pretty exact. There's no elasticity to it. There's no contraction. Why is our experience of time different? One of my assumptions is that if we don't understand ourselves in these experiences, that it's very difficult to represent Christ, to be about the business of ministry if you're living in anxiety or stress because of time. What
we're also trained that we're wasting time.
Okay.
So you feel like you have to be busy doing something.
Yeah, the stuff that Elmer talked about with Sittler, that most of us are 16th century dinosaurs, holdovers, and we feel guilty about our misuse of time. Okay, so maybe guilt is one of it. What else is common?
To me, a lot of those things you got up there don't have anything to do with time.
Right.
They really have to do with just situations or something, you know, like being in meals with teenagers. I assume there's conflict going on. There's no deadline you could, you know, to mm-hmm. that. It's not time related.
Right.
Particularly.
But it's time intensive. And intensive, the quality of the time is different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, but I thought we were talking about it from the standpoint of not having enough or something like that.
Right. See, I think the issue is not an issue of whether or not we have enough time, or whether we waste time, whether we use our time well, whether we learn to jog and listen to the Dow Jones stock average at the same time, and also compose the letter to your stockbroker. That to me isn't good time management anyway, but your comment was?
Just that it isn't applicable all the time, but at least in some of those cases, on the left you're talking about things that are, we feel, imposed upon us, and on the right we're making choices.
Very good. It's the imposition. The issue. And it's also those of you who have had any experience with trying to deal with stress. The issue is not stress, good or bad. The issue is what measure of control there is. I think that's what's so oppressive about poverty, Norm, is that there is no control. Too many projects. What is happening is the projects are controlling our life. Meals with teens. The teens are controlling the dinner hour, their schedules, their agendas, their needs, the imposed time limits. You didn't set the time limits. Somebody else set them for you. Or even if we impose them ourselves, they take a transcendent quality. We no longer... expectations, high standards, meetings, meals, traveling by plane. We don't set the schedule for traveling. The plane sets the schedule. And fatigue, in a sense, our body does. Here, no interruptions, the phones don't have control, vacation, we decide to do that, et cetera, et cetera. There's an interesting story that some of you may have heard that I think really is helpful as well as symbolic. There's an experiment that's been replicated many times and it has many derivation mutations that have been used with it. And there are two groups. And they were both being asked to perform a task that required both mental and hand dexterity, agility, I guess you would say, more correctly. And there was noise in both rooms, background noise, the clatter of typewriters, some voices going on, some street noise, background noise, and you still had to do this task. And in one group had to do the job and they were just there. The other group had some buttons at their work table. And they were told that those buttons could be used to control the level of background noise. Which group was able to more quickly and more accurately complete the task?
The ones with the buttons.
And what's the other thing that's fascinating about that group? Anybody know or remember?
sense of control.
They had a sense of control, but what was amazing is they didn't use the buttons. But they knew that if they had to, they could turn down the sound. So it's that sense of having some sort of control over one's destiny. In the workplace and dealing with people that, whom I supervise as well as those who supervise me, it's again and again, I see the way in which one approaches work is determined by whether that person feels she or he has a sense of control over their workplace. Another way to put it is whether one sees himself or herself as a victim. If you see yourself as a victim of all of these circumstances, then the stress level is very high. You have no ability to turn down the background noise. You have no ability to talk back to the boss. Whatever the boss gives you to do, you do. You have no ability to change the deadlines. You have no ability to change the standards. What my experience, and certainly there are exceptions of that, is that what happens is it is not just that there are mean bosses out there. It's not just that there are impossible standards. More often, in my experience, is that persons have participated in that process by imposing those standards upon themselves, by accepting some sort of mythical power that that boss or that supervisor has. And so, in a sense, we become our own worst time managers. And the challenge is to say, no, I am not a victim. I think there are theological grounds for making that statement, and it's been very difficult for me in a work environment to say, okay, what are those theological grounds? Do they have anything beyond my own unique perverted interpretation of Lutheranism? I don't know for sure. But I do think that Christians have the resources to say, ultimately, all of these standards, these outside control factors, don't count. Then I think it begins to be possible to change that dynamic. Any questions? I've talked too much. Anything from your own experience that either contradicts or confirms any of this?
Even the boss feels a victim.
Yes. Why is that?
I've tied up to expectations. You set certain expectations. You feel that you are not living up to what's expected if you don't do this and this and this and this and keep all these people happy and make sure that you do all these different things.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult being the boss.
Yes. And nobody knows that unless
she... They think you've got all the power.
Right.
In fact, you impose upon yourself as the boss all kinds of expectations that you're going to satisfy everybody, that you're going to make everybody happy, that they'll like you as a boss, which will never happen before.
Right.
You've been a boss before.
I've been a boss.
Yes.
The last 3 years I've been the boss.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody likes you.
Right.
And there's the mercy of your workers as well as their ability to do what's expected of them.
Right. The friend of mine, David Beckman, whom some of you may know, is a Lutheran pastor and economist at the World Bank. And just a few years ago, his major job was to write speeches for the president of the World Bank. And he saw that experience empathetically, that the president of the World Bank is the person in the World Bank with the least amount of power, the least ability to move or change events. Well, are we in a bind that we can't get out of? I think not, because there are these gracious events, these gracious situations in which the experience of not having control, of not having power over time, is shattered. Tell me about some of the times when things have suddenly changed and you felt like there was more time? What are those situations? You mentioned one when you said you get so fed up you just shove it all aside. Are there other experiences or other times that that happens?
Yeah, something somebody in my church said that I thought was so neat is, well, the whole idea of learning how to say no, being assertive, but then also just simply saying, when asked to do something, I cannot take that responsibility on at this time. And it just makes it cut and clear, and that's one last thing.
Okay. So you shove it aside, you say no.
And just telling somebody, quote, I cannot take on that responsibility at this time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice way of saying it.
Mm-hmm. It works.
Not that it happens very often, but when you feel successful, when you've met the criteria, you've met the timelines, at that point, you say, yeah, and it was manageable. And the feeling of being manageable creates seemingly more time.
Okay.
What you're saying is that you've done it before, so
you can do it again. Right.
I think that's one of the things that I myself at least have had a problem with, and that's being able to remember things like that and to make some major event out of some achievements. And
right.
It becomes a memory that you can use that again.
Most of us, before we even finish the task, have started working on the next one. Yeah.
Sometimes a change of job or even a change of location.
Ah.
I think corporations have found that's why they move people around, or some of them do, is it releases you from the burdens of that particular job, and for a while at least you're on a new one.
Yeah, I've changed jobs often enough, and there is that illusion that lasts for anywhere from 2 hours to 2 weeks is, oh, now I can relax. It's all, you know, life is but a dream. Somehow that new, the experience of a new job does that. Are there other places where time, yes?
Take time to think about your priorities. Maybe there are some things you're trying to do that shouldn't be done.
Okay. What Signe say is that, and we'll probably talk a little bit more about that, is somehow the process of setting priorities, at least in my experience, has been one that is gracious. Somehow it seems as though either time stops or there is more time. Maybe because you say no's, maybe because you shove some of it aside. I think there's some other reasons about that that I'll talk about just a little bit later, but that is one of those experiences. Yeah?
I think delegation, or being able to really give responsibility instead of people, get them off your back.
Okay, letting someone else do it, if I could put words in your mouth. Yes, sometimes.
I think it would be better if you take, if you're going from one job to another, so you're coming from work and going to come home and start something. You take 20 minutes for yourself.
Right.
And have a transition in your own.
Okay. The time for yourself is... Some of those times that I've experienced is that the appointment gets canceled. You didn't have anything to do with it, but events beyond your control, somebody canceled an appointment. Suddenly it seems as though there's a whole universe out there. I don't know what it is, you know, 1 half-hour appointment has been changed and you feel like God is indeed gracious. She does care about the overworked. Yeah.
In addition to letting someone else do it, is letting someone else have the responsibility and not worrying about whether they do it well or not at all.
Right.
That's hard.
That's very hard.
Especially if you have to redo it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Sort of related to the one back there, setting priorities. Sometimes, I think the original question was, I can't remember exactly.
When does it seem as though time is gracious, as though time has been created
because your priorities change, like the death of somebody very close to you or something, okay. You just say, none of it means anything.
Yes.
You know, it isn't important anymore.
I was going to say, going to a funeral.
Yeah. I know this sounds to some of you who are older, but for a 38-year-old to say, but I spend most of my life working with people who are under 30, many of them who are under 25, bright, intelligent young people who get so wrapped up in these events. And it occurs to me that many of them have not seen a young child die or to sit with a teenager who's dying of leukemia. You know, it just doesn't make a difference what color of pen you use, given that kind of reality, or if you go to a funeral.
Another time is when I have a lot of choices and can pick from any of 10, all of them being real positive possibilities.
Lots of choices, positive choices.
Yeah, positive.
Yeah, please.
It's similar to going to the funeral. It produces the same effect if you go to a, you know, grossly underdeveloped country and you see the kind of no choices those people have got, then you wonder, you know, why all these things you're flooding your time with. If they don't have that choice, how important can it be for you to do all those things?
Yeah, I was just going to throw out something similar. When asked to do something, instead of spending more time fretting about and how you're going to work it into your schedule, instead of just going ahead and getting it done, doing it, and then you actually end up with more time after it's over with than the before time of fretting.
I loved Elmer's phrase last night. So we're not going to talk about the doctrine of the Trinity. We're going to talk about the doing of the Trinity. And some of the stories in the New Testament, at least to me, are about stories about people who pick up and do it. The Zacchaeus and the tree. The other time that I've experienced is we used to live in northwest Indiana, where it would have a blizzard. And suddenly you had this whole schedule this week that was just filled with activities and deadlines to meet. And suddenly that snowstorm starts on Sunday. You can't do anything on Monday. And suddenly all of the time in the world is available to you, and all of those priorities become unimportant. Well, obviously the other time, I think that one of the reasons that many of us are here, I think, is that Holden seems to be, for many of us, a place where time is created, where we have the experience that time is more elastic. And I know that the times that I've been here, that has been the case, that there is, as though there is this magical place here where time becomes more available. And certainly we have lots of positive choices. You know, that there's too much, you thought you were going to be able to kick back for a week, but no. There's too many things to choose, but still, even given that, there is that sense in which time is created. The comment that Elmer made, we take our time with the feast here. It doesn't matter when Sunday Eucharist is over. Well.
Birdman of Alcatraz had lots of time on his
hands. Right. Yeah.
Do creative stuff.
But that does raise the flip side of this, and that because I'm sure that time, in a sense, was oppressive.
It's maybe not for him, maybe for some of the other prisoners.
Yes, right, for some of the other prisoners. There is, as in stress, people without stress are dead. Stress is part of living. Stress is the ability of the adrenal glands to respond to dangerous or critical situations. And one of the ways in which we cope in life, positively cope, is by having that extra spurt of energy. And those of us who feel we have some meaning and purpose in our life, I think, are people who live by schedules. Even at Holden, where time may be elastic, when you think about it, the schedule here is fairly rigid. Structure, time is structured very highly. We have a need to have schedules. One of the experiences of the unemployed, one of the things that's so devastating about their lives is the loss of that schedule, that loss of the pattern of their lives. So what I'd like to do is talk just a few minutes with you and also to get your ideas about how we can pattern our lives, how we can schedule our lives in a way that, A, gives us the vitality and the energy, if you will, to accomplish some of those things that we want to accomplish in time, and at the same time gives us the sense of control, the sense of freedom, the sense of grace that I believe makes it possible to be ministers, to be representatives of Christ in time. Well, another story that some of you may have heard about, the Hawthorne plant way back in the 20s. Again, another experiment that's been replicated in different situations. Women were assembling telephones, and there was a real desire to help them be more productive. So they conducted an experiment. Does anybody know how they thought they could help the women be more productive in making the telephones?
Just a guess, music.
No. They increased the lighting level. So they increased the amount of light in the room. And so they were able to produce more. It worked. Just to make sure that it worked, they lowered the lighting level. What happened? It increased even more. Then they went around and they said, why did your productivity increase even more? He says, well, you know, some of them have been there, spent their lives assembling phones and worked there a long time. He says, no one's ever come by and asked us about our work before. No one's ever paid any attention to us. In business management, that's called the Hawthorne effect. The effect of moving to a new office, the effect of buying new furniture, the effect of getting the new computers in. There is a momentary upswing in productivity that comes no matter what you do.
Right? That's not true with computers.
You're right. Except if you already have a bunch of computer literate people and you say, well, okay, we're going to get rid of the 8 megacycles and we're going to bring in these 16, which really in most day-to-day activities makes diddly squat difference. Somehow people are more productive. They think they've got a better tool when indeed they simply feel as though they're being paid attention to. However, the corollary of Hawthorne effect is that while there is an increase, there is an inevitable decrease. The effect of the new furniture wears out, the effect of the new computer wears off, and people revert back to a level of productivity prior to that Hawthorne effect. Well, two things. One is that I think that if we want to manage ourselves in time, again, my assumption is you can't create more time. It is a gracious gift. And our challenge is to manage ourselves in that 24 hours a day, that we have to do two things. One is that we have to always be changing the lighting level, if you will, change the level of the lights in our life. And secondly, we have to pay attention to ourselves, pay attention to the issue of our productivity. And so what I've learned is to feel comfortable with all of the tricks of turning up the lights, of turning down the lights, And I'm always amused by people that go out and buy these new expensive diaries, time management diaries, and boy, they work for the first week. Everybody writes down their goals and writes all their appointments in. And suddenly, in a week's time, they don't use them. And they say, forget this business about time management. I'm just going to go by. You know, you can't control your life. The boss is in charge. I'm just going to give up. Really, what is happening is the Hawthorne effect. And so what it means is that we have to have a whole repertory of tricks at our disposal, and we have to keep changing those tricks to pay attention to ourselves, to give ourselves the encouragement and the affirmation and the nudge that we all need. Let's try just to list a bunch of those. What are some of the tricks that you've learned to turn up the lights in your life to help you be a better steward of your time? Yes?
Make lists.
Okay. Make lists. That's what everybody always says.
Dovetail task.
Pardon?
Dovetail task.
What do you mean by dovetail task?
Doing two or three things at one time.
Ah, how can you do that? That doesn't make sense. I can barely do one thing.
Well, for Bernie's example, clean the house, have the clothes in the washer, and something on the stove. I mean,
okay.
Managing time.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
Prioritize.
Okay. Set priorities. What other tricks do you use?
I change the furniture when I get rid of it.
Okay, change the furniture. It works. Yeah, please, Kurt.
Even changing the tempo of music. You know, faster slow affects you.
Change music tempo.
Just like they do in the grocery store.
Yeah. Other tricks that you use?
Start earlier, work later.
Start early, work later. You're saying either or, right?
Yeah, or both.
Or both.
Even more effective.
I mean,
or you could start later and quit earlier.
Yes. Okay. Good.
Take a short nap.
Okay.
There you go.
Or other relaxation. Hire somebody to do it for you.
Good. Hire someone else, okay?
I thought it was interesting, Matt, this morning he was talking about one of our missions in ministry is to have a healthy life and to have fun. And so I think scheduling fun into the work that you have to do is something I never, you know, I don't think a lot of people really do that.
Taking a 3-hour lunch break.
Yeah, or taking, you know, like taking a nap, reading a cookie in the afternoon or something. To be good to yourself, maybe it'll give you more energy.
Mm-hmm. I've come to recognize that those of us who live in a world of business or in an organizational responsibility and who are probably guilt-ridden Lutherans besides, the only way to do this is to use that sense of compulsivity, that sense of guilt, and to schedule the fun. Now that sounds tragic in one sense, that it can't be spontaneous. On the other hand, it isn't going to happen otherwise. Certainly, my wife and I have learned that in our relationship. If you wait for that spontaneous moment, you're going to wait forever. It just isn't going to happen. You have to plan to spend time together. You have to plan to have fun. The best way is to write it into your calendar. And I've even gotten to the point where we publish our schedules in our office. I'll tell people, go to movie. I don't mind other people knowing that I set aside an afternoon to go and watch a movie. Yeah.
Don't let someone else ruin in your day.
Okay.
If the boss comes in and says you got to have this done by 2 o'clock this afternoon, don't let that just.
Okay, how do you do that?
I think just, you know, sitting back and relaxing for a while and
okay.
and trying to figure out, you know, just what we can do, and we can probably some dialogue, you know,
okay.
just to, you know, how do we really expect this to be done?
Okay.
I remember Boston very much was a victim. A program failed. He didn't do a lot of these things. And we were the program assistants, and it did take a lot of work to be, you had to be somewhat confronted with him, otherwise he would just throw it all on you and say, this has to be done. But I think maybe establishing that dialogue is just really, really important, and being able to confront situations that you're not in control of so that you can establish some control.
I think there are three ways to do that. One of the ways that I have used increasingly is to laugh at the boss. Because at one sense, you can't. Sometimes you can't even confront. Sometimes there isn't dialogue. And so the only... and you know, you get away with it. Somehow laughter is excusable. When we talked earlier about mealtimes being hairy, the time at which we experience that there just isn't enough time... the story of I guess I can tell of your family, Philip, where you still have quiet time before the supper starts, no matter how many lessons you've got up in the evening or how many commitments you have. Somehow you set aside that time before the meal starts every day. There isn't a sense in which quiet time seems to create time. Any other of the tricks that we have?
Get out of town, take a mini trip.
Okay, mini trip. Yeah?
I think one of the things, of course, it depends a little bit where you work and where you live, but just to walk outside and experience the environment that we live in, even if it's for 5 minutes, just to experience the air, the clouds, the trees, or wherever you are, and listen, and I think 5 minutes of that, if you don't have time for a 20-minute nap, can be very rejuvenating. But
yes.
To make the effort to walk outside and just be there in the midst of this time.
Or just walk outside and scream.
Good.
In India, it might take 3 days to make a phone call. So after the third day, it's useful to scream a little.
Yes.
That helps.
You show that you still have some control over it. Any other tricks?
At the risk of sounding materialistic, I have an aunt who, whenever she gets really swamped, she just says, I'm going to go shopping. Well, she never buys anything, but she just looks around and she thinks about different possibilities or envisioning different possibilities. And, also doing little luxurious things like taking those hot bath bottles or something. Something you would normally do.
Let's just take a moment and look at these things again, find out what the dynamics are, so that when we leave, we can create our own new bag of tricks. I think some things are happening here that give us some hints about our lives within time. One of the things that is true of much of this is that we are, we are spatial creatures, and we take our cues not just from the clock, but perhaps even more importantly, from space. The other thing that is related to that is that we are physical creatures. We most of us live lives of the mind. I mean, that is the curse of being part of the elite, is you use your head all the time. But that's just a small part of who we are. And if you look at many of these things, what we're doing is using our body to help us in time. What we do is we take a short nap, we walk. There is something beyond just the fresh air and the new experience. I think there is something that happens to all our entire body when we walk. Some of the literature now about walking is the best exercise. It's not just the physical exertion. There is something that happens, those of us who spend a great deal of time walking. I think it's a certain rhythm that gets reestablished. So often when we focus all of our mental energy, I think we lose some of that rhythm that is part of our entire body. We change our location, we change the music of the tempo, change the tempo of the music, etc. Often what you can do is to use that then even more to your advantage. One of the ways in a business situation or in an organizational situation, or even in the family, I found that it's tremendously helpful to stand. To say, okay, when you talk to certain people, you stand up and talk. What's the visual cue to yourself and to the other person?
Respect.
Respect, control.
Equality.
Eye to eye.
Power.
The other thing that happens is if you ever want to have a short meeting, you have it standing up. If you ever want to have a short telephone call, stand up. Because the cue in our bodies, for some reason, is when we're standing, is that it doesn't take as long. We're not going to be spending as much time.
Keep the motor running.
The other way,
it's often an insult, though.
Yes, you have to use it carefully.
Because if people come into your office and you don't sit down, I found that.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a cue, it's an easy cue, you know, you just stand at the door and mm-hmm. deal with the matter. But really, they can not tell you anything, but later on you can find out that it's blown it.
Sure.
If you don't sit down or play the proper protocol in terms of relating mm-hmm. to people.
I do think that what happens, and again this is part of my presupposition, that we do have at least penultimate control over our own lives, and we're not victims of every interrupter and every visitor, is to say, is to listen carefully and to see whether or not then to decide to sit back down. In some ways that can be more gracious. You know, we should really talk about this. Let's sit down and talk about it. It's a conscious decision to sit. Or, this is really important, let's meet later and sit down over coffee and talk about this, rather than letting that happen. The other thing that I've learned painfully over time about our bodies and about the visual spatial cues is to learn that certain spaces and places are for work and certain places and spaces are for play. And that if you want to accomplish work, that a desk is for working and your desk chair is for working, and to use it only for that purpose. And when you start to play in your chair and start to play at your desk and fiddle and doodle, you're in trouble. And that what you really need to do is to go someplace else and play. And so that you always, because we're creatures of habit, associate that place with work. The other thing that I think that I see here is the making of lists, the setting of priorities, and what are some of the other ones here? Talking about new possibilities. What I really think happens in the setting of priorities is not so much that we say, oh, I've got to do all of these things, I better get with it, Steve. Let's get to business here and start working. What I really think happens in these is not that you commit yourself to do all of that, but that you subconsciously and sometimes even consciously tell yourself, I'm not going to do some of it. That business of saying no. I don't think we're always upfront about it, but I think that that's what happens. We realize that some tasks are more important than others and that other tasks aren't going to get done. I have a friend who has this marvelous time management device. He has a never-do list. These are things I'm never going to do. And that doesn't mean that he's going to do, these are things like he's never going to drink, he's never going to take drugs. They're really valuable things that should be done, but he's never going to do them. The second thing that I think that is happening when we set priorities, when we create lists, when we explore new possibilities, is that it's frequently done how? How do we make lists? Do you make them in your head, Signe?
I write them down.
You write them down. When you set priorities, what do?
I start with the list and then prioritize.
Start with the list. I think that, and this whole business of having a diary and an appointment calendar, how many of you really use your appointment calendar to tell you all the things that you're going to do? And you look at it every time before you go?
Not always.
Something marvelous about writing. I think that what happens, something, and computers don't quite do it as well as the physical act of writing it on a paper. As Steve Jobs said, sometimes paper and pencil or paper and pen are the best way to do things. And certainly when it comes to setting priorities. It's as though we transfer the anxieties, we transfer the emotions, the longings, the dreams, whatever that are, somehow they get transferred to that piece of paper. I don't know what for sure what it is, but haven't we all had that experience of making out a list, and there is that sense of relief. And I think it's the relief in that, gee, the piece of paper is going to take care of this now. I don't have to worry about this as much anymore because there is this disembodied piece of paper that somehow is going to take care of it. Yes?
I think part of it, though, when we're working with intangibles, we need to make decisions and so forth.
Yes.
You set it all down, and then your subconscious works on it, and you don't have to worry about it. It's like you're talking about dovetailing tasks.
Yep.
You can be working on something else physically, but you know, mentally, these things are being worked on, and then mm-hmm. when it comes time to make the decision, quite lots of information has been absorbed and processed, and all of a sudden,
that's a good point, because what we've done two things. Actually, we've turned it over to the piece of paper, and we've turned it over to our subconscious, so that our conscious can work on what needs to be done at that particular time. You know, the whole business of why do people leave things on their desk? The three things you're supposed to do with paper are respond to it, file it, or throw it out. That's what they teach you. But we don't do that. I put them on my desk, or I put them here. Why do we do that? So we don't forget. And the problem is, we don't forget about it. We see it on our desk, we say, oh yeah, I got to answer that letter. I got to do that. And so what we really need to do is get it out of our conscious so that we can focus on what we need to work on. And certainly, your point is well taken, so that we can get it in our subconscious.
I think one thing that helps me in making the list is walking in 8 o'clock, whatever, the desk is really high.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to understand what's there. Just going through, taking an hour or whatever, and writing down, then I can see, oh yeah, it's manageable.
Uh-huh.
Something, you know, to tie back into what you were saying.
Right.
Without that, it's just overwhelming. It's just, right. Where do I start?
Yes. It's overwhelming. We've lost control. We're the victim again. And I think that the other thing that happens, in addition to giving structure, which is part of what you were saying, is that we have some framework on which we can hang all these disparate activities. The other thing that happens is that we do remember things. That one of the reasons when we write them down, it does help us remember. And that we can use our memory. The president of our company writes everything down, and I've learned over time that that still is the best way to deal with it. The final thing, and then we'll stop, is that I think one of the things that's happening here is that we're also rewarding ourselves. The point that you made earlier, that we're so busy achieving, we never take time to say, hey, I did it. And one of the things that I've learned painfully over time, because of my Methodist upbringing, is that you do deserve that if you want to accomplish more, you have to reward yourself for what you have accomplished already. And I didn't realize that when I was a child, but I would go with my father to the refinery where he was a supervisor, and I would sometimes look in the drawers, you know, like a curious little kid, and the guy had candy bars stashed in there. And of course, as a 6-year-old, I thought, gee, I can't wait till I grow up and I can keep candy bars in my desk. My father, I don't think, did it consciously, but it was a great time management device, because I'm sure that knowing my Father, that he used those to reward himself. When the task is completed, that you have the candy bar. I don't know what the candy bar is for you. Maybe it's working hard for an hour, taking that walk for 5 minutes. But I've found that if I decide before I start an activity, okay, what is going to be my reward when this task is over, that somehow the task goes much more easily. And I have come to accept that our human nature requires that kind of trick, that kind of conniving with ourselves.